following was produced by Pirate Radio Studios, Incorporated.
Hello, my name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland. Greetings, salutations, hello, hey, how's it going? throughout the course of, you know, this is a podcast called From Radioland, and here's the thing. I like to, as you've noticed already, I like to pull some stuff that we've actually recorded on the air, or from the air, from Radio Memphis, which is where I work. It's the day job, if you will, radio-memphis.com. And during a recent episode of Booze and Blues, Jeff Janowitz, Mark Caldwell, and myself sat down in the studio. We were getting ready to have us a fine evening of some great blues music and just, you know, music history and stuff like that. And here's the thing. It had come to us, Mark had called and said, hey, listen, you guys have an open hole in your schedule this particular date. And I said, yeah, we sure do. And it was sort of a last-minute thing. And we said, yeah, let's we always like to have a guest in whenever we can. And he offered us Mr. Howard Grimes. Just like that. And Howard is a guy that, if you don't know who Howard is, you're about to get an incredible lesson in the history of Memphis music. We're going to go back in time. We're going to go back into the 60s, in the early 60s. And we're not talking blues. We're not talking rock and roll. We're not talking, you know, the Elvis thing. We're not even going to get anywhere near that. We're talking about the birth of that soul stew. That Memphis soul stew, you know, the stuff from Stax, from High Records, Willie Mitchell, Al Green, the Bo Keys, the Marquees, all that stuff. You're about to hear from the man who was there when it happened. That's right. This guy was here from the very beginning of all of that and helped establish the sound that is to this day still stands the test of time. It's our great conversation we had with our new friend, Mr. Howard Grimes. Our guest this evening, we're mighty proud to have in here. The Memphis music scene you and I have discussed for years is just, it's steeped in the water, the air, the food that's here. It's everything.
That's right.
And this gentleman that's sitting here, in here with us has been part of every bit of that, as a good way to put it. Mr. Howard Grimes joins us. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
Doing well. Thank you for coming in and taking the time to come and sit with us this evening.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you, sir. Appreciate
it. But when I got down here, Mark had sent me some tunes that we didn't have.
Oh, okay.
A couple of tunes there of some stuff from the Bo Keys and some Willie Mitchell stuff that Howard played drums on.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Now, you've been playing drums most of your life.
All my life.
All your life.
You've been beating on something for
all this. So you started when you were 12, is that right?
I started playing in nightclubs, and I was 12.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so you started playing drums long before the...
I got my first session when I was 14.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
So
times were different back then, I'm thinking.
You just never had any question. That's what you wanted to do, was beat the skins, huh?
Well, I grew up... I saw a story of Gene Cooper. That's where it started.
Right.
And I wanted to do what I saw him doing. I didn't think a drummer could do that.
Yeah.
It was amazing to see a guy play drums and hands that fast.
Didn't he used to do the thing where he had the drumsticks under his armpits and he just swapped them out while he was playing?
Yeah, Art Blakely did that too, on that scene. But Gene Cooper was the first drummer I seen, so he enticed me, and that's where it all started.
It's a heck of a first inspirational drummer.
I'd say so, yeah. You got a lot of guys there to start, I guess, watching Gene play.
Yeah.
And you're still working, still beating it away, aren't you?
Yes. I just got with the Bo Keys 3 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And things took off with a very dear friend, man, wonderful lady, Cindy Laughlin.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
And it was amazing how it went down because she came to the studio and we got acquainted. And she didn't know the band she had, you know. She didn't know she had all Memphis musicians, like Skip Pitt, Leroy Hodges.
Who are these guys?
You know, and she had all these guys. So what happened is I kind of told her who everybody was.
Right.
She told me, she said, Howard, she said, I really was on my way to the Delta. That's what she was going to do.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
She said, well, something told me to come to Memphis. She said, I'm glad I came because I got what I was looking for. So that made me real happy.
Wow, that's
you know,
really
I hadn't played since Willie Mitchell had passed, you know.
Oh, really? You hadn't played that? In
the- you took some time off, did
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you retiring or were you just taking
no,
some time?
No, after Willie passed, it was a while before the company got in focus again.
Right.
And, I mean, I worked for Willie Mitchell 17 years, so, I mean, it was, I had to move. And I had heard about Scott Beaumont. And Willie's son, Archie Turner, was telling me he had Isaac Hayes drummer before.
Right.
Willie Hall.
Willie Hall, yeah.
He had him. That's... But it was kind of a little, he was having a little problem. And, you know, he was telling me Scott was having trouble with drummers. And I knew if I got with him, it wouldn't be no trouble. So I just wanted the guys that he was trying to work with that was causing so much trouble to give them an opportunity, and then I came. So I sat down and talked with him, and I ran the whole deal down. I told him the history of my life and how it was, and I didn't come for no money because I needed a job again.
Right.
I just wanted to pull him out the hole. I wanted to help him because from what I had found out, I talked to his mother. She said that drummers had given Scott a lot of problems, you know, and she said, I was losing my son until you came. She said, that's when I got my son back, because he's been happy ever since. So I've been happy, too, to work with him, you know. So well, that's where it began.
Well, that Cyndi Lauper album, that's that Memphis Blues album, and I remember when she did that. I was, first of all, it's a fantastic record.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, and I remember when that came out, like, it kind of threw me for a curveball. Like, Cyndi Lauper playing Memphis Blues, you know, still thinking of her as Girls Just Want to Have Fun, but she's got a great voice.
She does, and she's gotten better. You need to get her down here, Mark.
Yeah, Mark, you make that happen?
Can you make that happen?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, good, thanks.
Where did you guys record that at?
We cut it at Electric Phonics.
Okay.
Over on Main Street. You know, I've been passing that place for years and didn't know that it
didn't
was,
know it was a studio.
I didn't even know it was a studio. Scott told me later on, he told me that they did a lot of movie commercials in there.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's what they were shooting, movie commercials, and Lawyers was up in there, too.
Wow.
Huh.
That's the thing about Memphis. You drive around different parts of the city and never realize that there was... You know, like this room here, we were talking about Charlie Rich, a guy that you knew.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Great friend of mine, great artist.
Oh, yeah.
I met him through Gene Bowlegs Miller.
Yeah.
Gene Bowlegs Miller and him were very close friends. And they called him the Silver Fox.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He used to come down to the Flamingo Room. He used to come down to the Flamingo Room when I was playing with Gene Bowlegs Miller.
Yeah.
And he used to play... No One Knows What's Behind Closed Doors.
Oh, yeah, beautiful
favorite
song.
Favorite records, man.
Yeah, it was a great record. Yeah. People have referred to this room as the Fox Den. They still do. And I've heard it from other musicians. Goes, man, you're dead in the Fox Den, man. What the hell? I'm like, I don't want to know what's going on, you know.
Silver Fox is also what I call my girlfriend's mom.
You mentioned Willie Mitchell. I've got the tune here, Soul Serenade. This is a tune that you were on.
Cool. Yes.
And this was a hit. This was a big hit, wasn't it?
Big hit for Willie. I was playing at the time. I was playing over in West Memphis Plantation Inn.
Right.
I was playing over there for Mr. Lewis Jack, which was Floyd Newman's band. Isaac Hayes, myself. And there was two guys that lived over there, bass player. One had deceased, but Joe Woods was guitar player.
Right.
And what happened was...
This was back when Isaac was just playing the keys, right?
Yeah. He wasn't doing that much.
he wasn't doing a whole heck of a lot of that.
But what happened is I left Floyd Band and got with Willie. And I had been hearing all of Willie Mitchell's music, you know, down through the years, and they had Harlem houses and jukeboxes And when I get out, we played from 9 to 4 in the morning. So, you know, like when I get off of work, I go to Harlem House and eat. And I just go to the box and play Willie Mitchell's music. And I was listening, not knowing it was Al Jackson drumming.
Yeah.
So I want to play that music. I want to play with that band. Never knew I was going to have an opportunity to play with them, but I did. I come over there in 68. And we had the pleasure to do Soul Serenade, which was King Curtis' song. And Teeny Hodges, which was a great writer, great rhythm guitar player, and he could turn a record around in 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
And what he did, he flipped the record from the soprano solo to a lead guitar.
Huh.
And Willie flipped. And he said, hey, we're going to cut this. So we cut it, and it was a major hit for Willie.
What year was this record done?
1968.
You mind if we play it?
No, I love to hear it. It's my favorite.
It's a good tune. It's Willie Mitchell's Soul Serenade here on Radio Memphis. Mr. Willie Mitchell, Soul Serenade.
Yeah,
yeah,
man, that was a great record. You know, the tenor player on that record is Charles Chalmers.
Yeah.
He's actually original Memphis horns. But he started singing background, which was with the Rhodes sisters.
Yeah.
I used to watch Slim Rose back in the day on Channel 13. And Charles married Sandy Rose. And they became the backup singers for High Records. A lot of people never knew that.
Wow. Wow.
Man.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they're the backup singers. They own all that product over there.
Wow. When, you know, in the mid to early 60s, I guess, is that really when the whole Memphis sound like this really kind of came together? Was it then or was it before then? You know, when would you...
It actually came together at that time when I came to Willie.
Yeah.
Because Al Jackson had went to Stax.
Right.
And what had happened, Al Jackson had been playing with Willie quite a while at a club called the Manhattan Club.
Yeah.
And I was playing out to Curvis Tropicana on Thomas.
Yeah.
And what happened, it seems like I was following Al Jackson's footsteps and he was following mine. I don't know what was happening, the way it was going down. But I found out some years later, we were the only two drummers that they used on everything, Al and myself. So
So drummers were just as hard to come by. Good drummers were just as hard to come by back then as they are now, huh?
Well, we was actually, from what Willie told me, Al Jackson and my timing was the only two perfect timing drummers. And they used nobody, wanted nobody else on sessions. So
right.
We was kind of rotating around. And what happened when he left, Willie, he went to Stax, where Steve Cropper was the one that caused him to come off of Green Onions.
Right, yeah.
And what happened when he left and went to Willie, then Willie discovered me through, well, Teeny, because I was really actually getting ready to go out on the road with Paul Van and the Raiders. So I went on that tour.
Yeah.
With Steve Lamo, Tommy Rose, Keith Allison. So I went out on the tour with those guys. And then I come home and I hooked up with Willie.
What is it about this area and this music? Is it just the people here, you think, that it just flows through here? Because these guys you're talking about are all, they're and yourself, are just huge benchmarks in the music world. And Memphis at that time was just ground zero for everything.
I think what it is, I heard Willie always make a statement about, he said people, it's two different segments of people.
Yeah.
As far as the music, he says some like it funky and some like it more in a modern progressive style of playing. He said, but Memphis is the rock gut.
Yeah.
Funk.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's what yeah. It is.
Makes sense.
Yeah, because we still see it today. You know, that hasn't changed at all.
No.
Styles, you can hear a band anywhere and go, that's a Memphis sound.
Absolutely.
There's something there. And it may be somebody who's just a big fan of the style, a guitar player, a keyboard player, a horn player. It doesn't matter what they're playing, but bass. These Absolutely. Guys, they're hearing that, and they're incorporating it into their style of music.
Absolutely.
And it's like, wow, that's... And then you find it, you talking to these guys, and they go, oh, yeah, we love everything that came out of Memphis. You know.
Right. Willie Mitchell always said it was the musicians.
Yeah.
That's what he said. He says the musicians. The guys got that feel. They got that... soul, he got that instant touch that's in him, and it's true.
It's in the blood, without a doubt.
The feel,
well, you know, I know back, especially in the '60s, we've talked about it in the show before, where Memphis was. I mean, the music industry was the lifeblood of Memphis mm-hmm. at one time. I mean, it was not just the recording studios and the record shops, but it was the distributors that industry was here. And of course, you know, there's a lot of the session players running around. We kind of built up that industry of session players that we don't. I don't know. I'd say we don't have it now, but you see a lot of cross pollination with the bands.
It is. It's kind of there. It's different, but it's
Brandon
there.
Brandon Santini will play on a Ghost Band,
right?
You know, Ghost Town Blues Band track or whatever. But it's not like it used to be, where somebody could just make a comfortable living as a session player. Did you prefer going on tour and backing people or being in the studio and laying it down? What was your, or did you have a preference?
Yes, well, I always wanted to go on tour, but I never understood Willie didn't want me out there.
Yeah.
Because of the sound, the drums. He didn't want nobody to know what I was doing.
He didn't want me to know. He didn't want me to make it off with you.
So...
Hey, so you're not going anywhere, Howard. You're staying right here.
He would let the guys, when Al Green would go to Johnny Carson's show,
uh-huh.
Al Jackson went in my place.
Oh, really?
And Leroy Hodges. And I often wonder why, you know, but he wouldn't let me go nowhere.
Well, you know, back to your point earlier, he said that you and Al Jackson had the perfect timing, the only two drummers he could find with that timing. And I think... it may be lost on some of our audience how important that is, especially with the recording technology of the day. It's not like today where you
backbone. Yeah, you got guys playing on click tracks.
Click tracks, and it's all digital, and it's all.
And you know, you're not a click track guy.
You can bump the tracks, so you can nudge
it. Willie did put me on click track first time.
Did he?
Put me on the click track to test me in the ceiling. He found out my timing was more perfect than the click track. He never did use me on the click track anymore, but it was a great experience because it was my first time knowing what the click track was. I didn't know nothing about that.
That throw you off?
Put this clock up here, man, and this hand going, you know what I'm saying? Oh. But it's great.
Yeah. Well, you know, these days you can, you know, you can, somebody can get into the audio file and nudge everything to get all the issues back.
They can digitally manipulate it.
It's not the same. It backed in on tape, on that big tape, and it's expensive. Like every minute that thing's turning.
Oh, yeah, that's like a meter running.
Burning money, and you can't afford to have.
You know, I guess I can say this. Willie Mitchell, I have to give him the credit because I had played on a tradition of band teachers, which was leaders. They were band leaders.
Right.
My teacher, Mr. Emerson Abel, from Announcer High School, is where I come from. And he had put me in his band when I was in high school. And I played with Bob Talley, which was the first musician in Memphis that was doing all of the... And I played at the Hi-Hat Club out there nightly.
This is when you're still in high school.
I was still in school.
Yeah.
But when Willie took under me, Chip's Moment gave me so much room to just be free. Chip's was the man that really... I don't know what he saw in me, but... He always gave me a great smile. He gave me a thumbs up when I cut. And me being 14 years old, I was happy. You know? I said, well, my job must be.
Made somebody happy there. Yeah, no, he's pleased with my work. I guess I'll keep doing it.
Right. So, right, you know, I just went, you know, I went along. He never, anything that I did, he agreed with it. I used to come up when we didn't have percussionists. He's like, they had these old ashtrays that used to sit with the sand in it.
Mm-hmm.
And he needed a cowbell. I took the top off and pulled the sand in the garbage. I took a drumstick and I played. He said, how would that work? So we didn't have percussionists or nothing, you know. Yeah. So everything was being created.
But that's what makes such wonderful sounds. And, absolutely. You know, you go back and you hear that and goes, man, it's a great cowbell, isn't it?
That's it. Yeah, nobody never knows because I never say anything.
And it wasn't in the liner notes either, I don't think.
And I remember, if you listen at that Marquise album, it's a song on there called Misty.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never said this, but I think I shared it with you once, Mark. But anyway, Wayne Jackson, Chip's Moment took a milkshake cup, and he poured a half cup of water, took a straw. And Wayne Jackson has got this milkshake cup. He wanted to make it sound like we're on this sea.
Yeah.
And he's blowing.
Blowing bubbles.
And Chip's put it in the echo chamber.
Yeah.
So it's sounding like we're on this cruise ship. If you listen at it, you know.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's amazing.
So, you know, I mean, like you said, we had a lot of things was creative. You know, we didn't have anything. Chips was just great.
It's not just about the backbeat. It's everything that goes in it. You know, there's so much, you know, to add to it and to make it work.
Well, you know, when you talk about what you can do digitally now, there was a time when that's, you know, that's how you got sound of the studio. There's a book called Sonic Alchemy that talks about just studio engineering and production back through like the 50s. Mm-hmm. About guys throwing microphones in a bucket just to get a different sound out of it and singing into the bucket.
Practical effects.
A lot of that stuff you just, you know, absolutely, you take for granted now because that's, you can push a button
and there it is, you know.
Do it, but yeah.
That's what we was working with during that time.
Could have had to make it up as you went along, right?
I came to Satellite with Rufus Thomas in 1958. So it really wasn't anything there in the studio. It was my first time. I never thought I would have been recording any records. I know nothing even about it. But Chip was just so loyal. You know, he was such a great, he's really like my dad, you know. That's the way I look at it. I seen him back here since they put the
Oh, the highway marker, the historical marker that they did?
Got pictures on it. A friend of mine sent me from New York.
Yeah.
And Scott and I went out. Scott said, go over and see him. And so many people was there trying to. And I got in line, and he kind of had his head down. Mm-hmm. And when I walked up, I said, Mr. Bowman, I said, it's Howard Grimes. How you? And he looked up, and he just lit up. You know, I got the pictures. And he just grabbed my hand. And he just held on to me. First thing he said, how was you cutting any records? I said, yes, I'm cutting. He said, oh, I know about Scott Beaumont. He said, we talked. So that's one of the greatest time of my life to see the joy in him. You can see it.
Right.
The pitches, man. And I just loved him, man, because he... He's a great man, you know, him and Willie, Rufus, you know, these were the people that in...
I was fortunate enough to meet Rufus a couple of times before he passed, and just what a sweet guy, you know. I had a bowl of ice cream with him at the Rumbuggy Cafe. Oh, wow. Yeah, it was in the summer. It was like a lunchtime. It was afternoon thing, and he happened to be down there, and and I sat down, and he had a bowl of vanilla ice cream. I said, "That looks pretty good." And he says, "Well, come on, let's have some ice cream." So we ate ice cream together, and he was telling me about that whole world's youngest teenager bit, and you know the costumes and stuff. And it was just such a wonderful little moment. You know, I loved him to death. It was so sad to hear that he had passed. And
yes, you know, when I came. Well, he kind of guided me through my mother to cut the first record. I cut the first hit record, Cause I Love You, with him and his daughter, Carla.
Yeah.
I didn't know Rufus played drums. Rufus played drums. And I always, you know, if you notice drummers in concerts, when they end, they shine. You know, they do their little thing.
Right,
you know?
Right.
On the record I cut, when it ended, I was doing that. And Rufus said, none of that. He said, wait a minute, I'm going to show you how to, I can play drums too. So he told me, he said, you get up. So I got up, and he shocked me, and he played. He said, now when you end the song, this is the way I want you to do it. And he showed me how to end it. And until this day, I still end when I do tracks, sessions, from that. He said, don't do all of that there. He said, just do ba da ba ba bo ba da ba do ba ba
boom. Oh, yeah.
There it is.
The little sting, yeah.
That's it. He said, you got the last beat. That's it.
Yeah.
So I do that today. All my sessions, I've been doing it all my life.
Mm. Are you playing live much these days?
Well, I've been touring with the Bo Keys.
Yeah.
Scott and him. Scott is out right now with Charlie Musselwhite. So he'll be in next week.
Yeah, next week. I say Charlie Musselwhite will be here next week.
For yeah, sure. Because we're doing we're
Blues,
doing
the Music, Blues Awards. Music Awards. Are you performing at that?
Yes, we're working with Candace Staten, John Namath.
That's right. Of course, you're performing that because that Memphis Grease album's got 6 nominations.
Yeah, we up for one. We up for best album.
Yeah,
we's up for the best album. That's going to be exciting, man.
That is. So how did you play drums on every track on that album? I know Bo Keys are pretty much his backing band on that album. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a fantastic record.
I have queued up over here the Bo Keys with Otis Clay and Got to Get Back.
That's a great record, man. That's the one.
Radio. I got to get back to my baby.
Radio Memphis. How about that? There you go.
The song there, Everybody's Music, from Howard Grimes, and ahead of the Bo Keys, featuring Howard on the drums there. Also Otis Clay, and Got to Get Back to My Baby. Howard's here in the studio here. That record, Everybody's Music, that's on a collection of tunes from a bunch of drummers, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. That's that project came from Yoko Ono from Japan.
Really?
Yes.
She just had a thing for drummers, I guess?
Yes, well...
Except for Ringo.
She also had did a constellation of bass players, too.
Yeah.
And when they selected me, it came through Bernard Purdy.
Yeah.
Who I knew about. I knew his work, but I never met him. He's one of my mentors. I still listen to him today.
Yeah.
And what happened was they called the studio to Willie Mitchell. The acts, they had a meeting on me in New York, these drummers, and Mr. Glenn Dorsey was Yoko Ono's agent.
Yeah.
So he was the one who called me, you know, and he told me, he said, Howard, they have all of the drummers but you, and Bernard have chosen you, and we don't know whether we can get you or not. Would you be interested in being on the project? And I thought it was a great shot for me, you know.
Right.
So he told me, he said, I said, well, who told you? He said, well, we called down the studio and asked Willie Mitchell, who was the top drummer in Memphis. He said, we knew it was you because we knew your work. We've been following you for years. We knew all the work you've done here.
Wow.
He said, but we wanted to hear it come out of Willie Mitchell's mouth.
he could have said Al Jackson.
And I was really just shocked. I was overwhelmed, man, you know, because I truly.
That's a great honor. Yeah.
I said, did Willie actually tell you that? He said, oh, yeah, he told me. He said, we knew it. He said, but we just wanted to hear it come out of his mouth. He said, after he told him.
He didn't know he was going to lose you for a little while on that deal. Yeah, it's a neat. Did you write that song, or was that something? Yes. Yeah, he did.
I did the song over in Al Green's studio.
Yeah.
Al had come to my house after he left High Records.
Yeah.
He had a studio called Al Green's Enterprise. And it was out there off Brooks. And I went out there. What had happened, Mr. That used to work at High Records.
Yeah.
He made the board, Mr. Cantrell. And Mr. Cantrell had built the board for Al, the studio. So Alan left Willie.
Right.
He's got his own thing now.
A custom board, too.
So what happened... Mr. Cantrell called me out there. He had several drummers was out there, but he didn't know what he had building the board, you know. So
right.
He said, Howard, he said, I told Al, so you need to call Howard in here. He said, let Howard play drums. We'll know what we got. So he worked over the High Records and said, I know him. So they did. They called me, and I came out. And I cut Al Green's Grammy hit. It was called Highway to Heaven. And that's what set things in pace. So he gave me an opportunity to come up. He asked me, he said, how have you ever thought about recording? I said, man, I'm a drummer. I can't even. Who's going to put some money behind me? I said, man, everybody going to. I help other people. I play drums for people. He said, nah. He said, you never know, man. He said, why don't you try to come up with something? So I tried to hold the high rhythm set because at that time we had kind of separated. But the guys wouldn't go with me. So I took it up on my own. I got my little nephew and a bass player. He had Cease. His name was James Price. Went in and we come up with this. And I called Darryl Carter in late on. He had come here. And what we did, all the stuff that I've recorded over there, we were getting ready to record it at Electric Phonics.
Right.
So that's how the record come out. So the record sit on the shelf for 10 years until Yoko Ono come along and give me the opportunity. I didn't really actually know what to do because I asked her, I said, what you want me to cut? She said, well, you got any originals? You cut what you want. We want you on this project. So I said, well, yeah, I got an instrumental I wrote. So she said, well, do that.
There you go.
And they accepted, and what happened, man, that record moved from the first project was called In the Pocket.
Yeah.
And they moved my record off of there, so it's on two different CDs.
Hmm.
But wow. I wasn't getting any airplay here. I got a friend.
You will now.
Out of San Francisco. Well, thank you very much. I got a close friend, DJ of mine out of Detroit.
Yeah.
I mean, not Detroit, I'm sorry, San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
named Harry Duncan. And he plays it. And my attorney out of St. Louis, Bruce Banner, he plays it. Bruce called me one night. He played on the air. And he said, Howard, your record went all the way to Australia. I thought he was joking. He said, they called. He said, the phone just lit up. He said, the guy asked him, said, that's Memphis Sounds. I know. He said, would you play that? And he said, well, no, I can't play it tonight. He said, I'll play it next week when I come home. So that's all I've received from those two friends of mine, my attorney and Harry.
Oh, we'll help so you out. We'll help you out a little
you
bit.
You guys here yeah, with Marvel, man. I'm grateful to be here. I didn't know this. It's a blessing this happening, man.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
To me.
No, Amber. We're just damn glad that you've got the time to sit down and yeah, and talk with us. You know, the stuff that I'm hearing, too, and I understand you're in the process of writing a book.
Yes.
Oh, man, I want to read it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like right now.
That happened with a great friend of mine named Preston Lauterbach.
Mm-hmm.
Both of us was down on out of luck, and he came here through my band teacher, Mr. Emerson Abel.
Right.
He made contact with Mr. Abel, and like I was saying earlier, nobody never really wanted me to talk. Mr. Abel didn't want nobody. Willie Mitchell didn't either. You know, they didn't want me to talk.
Well, that's because they know that drummer is back there behind the kid just taking it all. He's got all the stories.
He's got everything.
Knows where all the bodies are buried.
Yeah.
It's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
So, you know, what happened, Preston called me. And he said, Howard, he said, your band teacher, Miss Emerson Abel, told me that you would talk. And I said, you sure you talked to Mr. Abel? He said, oh, yeah, he said, I talked. So I called Mr. Abel. He said, yeah, he said, he's about the only decent guy in Memphis, real brother. So I started taking him around. I took him around the clubs. Write his book, which was called The Chitlin' Circuit. I don't know if y'all seen that book.
No, but
I've heard of that book. Yeah, because that's I've been fascinated with the Chitlin' Circuit.
Great book.
Yeah,
it's a great
everything.
Book.
Yeah,
and I didn't know he was going to put me in the book, and I gave him a lot of pitches and told him a lot of musicians and how seduction and everything started. I took him to some of the grease spots and the places. So. Me and him became friends behind that, and he had me out to a Rose College. I've been out there, and I've spoke. Matter of fact, I just did an interview about a month ago at Bill Street at Church Park for Rose College again.
Oh. Hmm.
And they got involved finding out that Preston was writing my book. So they offered to sponsor the book. They said, well, we doing Preston's book. And said, we know your book is going to be finished, so we want your book. I want to read
nice.
This.
Nice, yeah, yeah.
So that was a blessing to me, man. You know, it really was.
So when can we expect to see it? When's it?
He said my next birthday it'll be finished.
Yeah.
Because we've been working on it now 3 years.
Just you're going through all the stories, just reminiscing, walking down those roads.
Man, I will.
I'm going to tell you what he told me. He said, Howard, he said, you're such an amazing guy in memory at your age. He said, most guys your age are 73, man. He said, they can't remember across the street.
Yeah.
He said, but you, man, he said, it's amazing how you know all the musicians. You put everything in line. He said, when I sit down and hear you, man, on tape, he said, you're like a Bible. He said, you start talking and everything just falls in place. He said, he can understand you. And I thought, coming from him, him being a book writer, and he, you know, so many books and people that he, and he said, man, this book is going to be great. He said, you're going to help a lot of musicians.
Yes.
You're going to help a lot of people, man. And I did another, they hadn't shown it yet, but I did another book for Smithsonian that haven't been released yet. But,
oh, really?
Yes, I did. Smithsonian have documented telling me. And the guy that did it used to work for Pop Tunes.
Mm-hmm.
And he interviewed me.
With Jimmy Burge? Or?
Not him.
Okay.
No. Oh, I can't. As well as I know him, I can't call his name.
Right? I think he used to be like a manager of Pop Tunes. It's like, yeah. One of the owners, I don't remember. A long time. So I'm 41, and I can't remember nothing.
Yours is self-inflicted, though.
Yes, well, you know.
which happens amongst you musicians. I know how that goes.
But I tell you what, as a native Memphian and a lifelong musician myself, you don't get a, you know, you have to kind of seek that history of Memphis music out and put the pieces together yourself. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of books on it. I mean, I know there's some, but to hear the point of view of somebody that was there, to not the beginning of it, because I guess that would be W.C. Handy or further back. But
yeah. He's not that old.
But the beginning of that golden age of the Memphis, that Memphis sound, please let me know when it's ready.
Yeah, that's going to be a wonderful book. Yeah.
Yeah, that's something I'd devour.
Well, it's an honor to know that, because so many people have said the same thing that I heard you gentlemen say. Hey, man, when that book come out, you know, I'm going to buy that, but I want that book.
Yes,
you
know? So, yes.
I really owe everything to Chip's Moment and Mr. Emerson Avery, my band, teaching all of the great musician that I was such a young guy that they took me under their wings.
Right.
Like Fred Ford.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't know about Bill Ford. Bill Ford is the tenor player on The Crawl, Willie Mitchell's first record.
Huh.
These was the guys that, I was 12, these was the guys that was on Beale Street playing.
Yeah.
You know, Club Handling, Flamingo Room, you know.
And, yeah, because there's quite the... There's a history to that, to playing on Beale. I mean, you know, it's a tradition that still, thankfully, is still around. And that's street knowledge that goes right into the studio, right onto the stage, that a lot of guys don't really think about.
You know? So I got to ask this. What did your parents think about you playing on Beale at that age?
They didn't know, I bet, right? He was sneaking out. I'll be over at Freddie's house, Mom.
Well, you know, my mother, Floyd Newman, Mr. Abel, Bowlegs, these guys she always held them responsible for me. She always told them, I'll let you have my son, but you're going to have to take care.
Right.
So I was always under good care, you know.
Yeah.
The only thing about it, you know, back during the time I started out at Kirby's Tropicana, Mr. Kirby and Miss Susie place. And that's where I saw all of the big acts. And, you know, back in the day, they used to have a vice squad. Vice squads was detectives.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to make their rounds in clubs. And by me being, they allowed me to play. But I couldn't be out in the audience.
Right.
Around alcohol.
Yeah.
Right.
That makes sense.
And they would come to the club to see was I sitting out there when I take a break.
Yeah.
And Mr. Kirby and them always, they had me in the kitchen.
Huh.
So, you know, they'd give me hamburgers and Cokes and stuff. So I was cool.
Yeah.
You were all right.
Yeah, I just love to play, man. You know,
get some blade to get the
eat.
People were so happy, man. Yeah. So much love.
Yeah.
You know, and the only thing about the black clubs I played there, I just played so long, you know, because before the people would get into the music, they had to get drunk, man.
Yeah,
it'd be almost time to go home. They get up on the dance.
Right.
I'm about ready to go home, see. But when I started on the other side, playing with Tally, it was a much more relaxing for me because the white audience that I played for, they explode and applaud the moment they heard the music.
Yeah.
And that was a new thing to me, you know, and then I didn't have to play as hard, you know, and I enjoyed that more because I learned how to play calypso, rumba, samba.
Oh, man.
I was playing all that rhythm at the hi-hat club with Miss Betty's club. It was out here on 3rd Street out here.
Oh, yeah.
And then I went to Plantation Inn over. I played for Mr. Louis Jack.
Yeah.
So I played there. They had Punchos across the street, so on the break, I'd go to Punchos and get a bowl of chili.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, you know.
Punchos.
Because I had to play from 9 to 4 in the morning.
Oh, God, that's a long night.
And then going to school the next day? Or? Yeah.
And see Rufus Thomas.
Yeah, sure.
Rufus used to take me when I was in his group. Rufus was always before he'd take me home. He said, well, we're going to go down to Handy. And he would take me down to Club Handy. That's where I first saw the big band.
Right.
Oh, man.
Right.
And I saw the big band in there. And
well, I bet that changed everything, dude.
It did. Yeah. And it was exciting to me to see that, you know. And he used to send me up to the stage. He said, go up there and stand beside the drummer. So I went up there and I stood beside him. But one night, Joe Duke was playing. He's a great drummer from Booker Washington.
Yeah.
And Joe went into his solo. He was doing his thing. I'm standing on the side of him. You know, all of a sudden he went, you know, his solo, boom, bam, you know, and it scared me, man. I jumped. It scared me. What's wrong with this guy, man?
He's crazy.
I didn't know this guy was, but he's into his thing, you know. Scared me, man. You know, Rufus said, no, said, when you see him like that, he said, he into his thing, man, you know, and he's getting in another gear, so he's getting everything out. That's it. So I found out what that was about.
Here's what's coming up on the next episode with Rick Cheddar from Radioland.
He'd never really told the story before, and there it was as it happened live on the air at Radio Memphis, and we were right there in the middle of it, and he got to tell the story. Plus, you're going to hear some of his music, and you're going to hear more of the wonderful stories and the life and the history of Mr. Howard Grimes. He continues part two from Radioland.
He said, Howard, he said, do you know that your drum's supposed to be tuned? I didn't know what he was talking about, because all I did was turn knobs and sit down and play. So what happened? He said, I'm going to show you. And this was really amazing to me. That's really why nobody knows. Willie didn't even know it, because when I came to hear him, when he found out the sound I had on drums, McGee, the same notes on drums as on the bass.
Rick Cheddar from Radioland is produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. You can subscribe to the show through iTunes, Player.fm, TuneIn, and Stitcher. You can also listen online and download past episodes at radio-memphis.com.
Mark, you said you had a...
Yeah, I just wanted to get just a quick story. I was interviewing Don Nix about a year ago right now for the Memphis Blues Society, and... Don, of course, is fascinating on his own.
Right. Oh, yeah. And,
Anyway, Don was telling me he was out in L.A. in the early 70s. He was with Leon Russell out there. And he had met the receptionist at Apple Records. And one day he was up at her house.
Uh-huh.
It was in Hollywood Hills, I think. And Don told me he had always wanted to know how the beginning of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, how they did that song,
right?
The Beatles. Well, that day, while he was up at her house, he found out George Harrison was coming. And, of course, Don told me what he was thinking about. He wanted to ask about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Well, the first thing that George said to Don after he introduced himself, he goes, have you heard of Howard Grimes? And
really?
George Harrison said this to Don in the early 70s. So the musicians knew about Howard.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
This is from George Harrison.
Wow.
And, of course, he didn't even get to say anything about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
He didn't care. He was more interested in Howard. Yeah.
So wow. I just thought that was so cool.
That's amazing.
George asked about Howard.
Yeah.
And
so. George was my favorite Beatle anyway.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, that's, you know, Andrew Love and Wayne Jackson, they traveled a lot once they hooked up as the Memphis Sound.
Yeah.
Right.
And when they would come back home, Willie have sessions set up. That's the only time I got to be with them when we do sessions. They would always tell me, and I thought they was joking. They always tell me, they said, how would you, you know, we play overseas and we do concerts. Say, you know the first name come up? He said, they asked for you.
Yeah.
Say, they said, do you know Howard Grimes? Do you play with Howard? He said, yeah, we work with Howard all the time. We on all the sessions Howard on over that. That was shocking to me. You know, they always told me that.
Yeah.
You get around, Howard.
Yeah. I see. Yeah.
more people know who you are than you think.
Yeah, I'm beginning to understand. Yeah. I believe that now.
When we come back, I was going to play a couple of tunes off of the Memphis Grease record, John Namath's.
Great record, man. Great album.
And it's up for, what did you say, 6 awards?
Is that, well, John, I think John himself, between best album, I think harmonica, there's best song, he's up for 6 BMAs off of that album. Nominations off of that album.
That's fantastic. I was going to play If It Ain't Broken, Elbows on the Wheel.
There you go.
Great songs, man.
Yes.
All right. So stick around. We got more fun coming up next right here on Radio Memphis.
Remarkable stuff indeed. And we were certainly just beyond words to describe what it was like to sit down in the presence of such music greatness. I mean, when you're talking about musical royalty, it really doesn't get too much higher than Howard Grimes. You know, he was the true session guy. He's the guy that that you have heard him play all of your life and did not even realize it. And that's the beauty of it. Now, obviously, you hear what's coming up next week. And let me tell you something about that. I mean, you're going to hear a lot of some of his new stuff. He's working with John Namath, that record is up for all these fantastic awards, called Memphis Grease. Go get it. John Namath, Nemeth. He basically has the bow keys and the high rhythm section behind him. It's just an absolutely beautiful record. You heard you will be hearing 2 cuts off of that record next week. So you got that going for you. Fantastic stuff. My undying thanks to Mark Caldwell for making all this happen, and of course our thanks to Mr. Howard Grimes for taking the time to sit down and tell us about what all this is. I've been taken to school. It was just that cool. So. There you go. We're looking forward to it next time. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. Take care of one another. We'll see you next time. I'm Rick Cheddar, and this has been From Radioland.
The proceeding was produced by Pirate Radio Studios, Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. For more audio on demand, go to radio-memphis.com.